Lesson 20, Section 1, News in Brief.
The Pentagon today called on the highly publicized withdrawal of Soviet troops from Afghanistan a sham. Moscow announced earlier this month that it would complete the withdrawal of 6,000 men from Afghanistan by the end of October. NPR's Alan Berlow has the story.
The head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Lieutenant General Leonard Perutz, said the Pentagon has developed clear and convincing evidence that the Soviet troop withdrawals are a deception. Perutz said the Soviets deliberately inserted additional tank and rifle regiments into Afghanistan for no reason other than to withdraw them.
What the Soviets have done is to remove some unneeded units and to substitute others so that the number of military useful troops in Afghanistan is basically unchanged.
Farooq said half of the Soviet units withdrawn were for air defense. Since the Afghani Mujahideen rebels have no air force, Farooq said the Soviet withdrawals have no military significance. Farooq said the withdrawals were designed to enhance General Secretary Gorbachev's image at home and abroad. He said about 116,000 Soviet troops remain in Afghanistan. I'm Alan Berlow in Washington.
South Africa's black miners have observed a one-day strike to mourn the deaths of 177 of their co-workers killed in a fire at the Kinross gold mine last month. Workers in other industries also participated in the symbolic action. Nigel Wrench reports from Johannesburg.
More than a quarter of a million black miners were on strike to protest their colleagues' deaths. About half the country's total of 600,000 gold and coal miners, costing the mining industry an estimated $4 million. The stay-away was total at the Kinross gold mine where last month's disaster occurred. Black miners stayed inside their barrack-like hostels. Reporters were barred from the mine. In central Johannesburg, a protest meeting was held by the Black National Union of Mine Workers, which called the strike action. A union spokesman said miners had gathered not to mourn, but to commit themselves to liberation from apartheid and economic exploitation. White church leader Beyers Naudia told the crowd, "The accident at Kinross need never have occurred, and the 177 men need not have died." For National Public Radio, this is Nigel Wrench in Johannesburg.
The King of Saudi Arabia has removed Sheikh Ahmad Zaki Yamani as Saudi Arabia's oil minister. Yamani had held the job for 24 years. Although it's been rumored for a few years that Yamani was out of favor with the king, his firing shocked the oil market. Yamani's replacement, Hisham Nizer, Saudi Arabia's planning minister. NPR's Barbara Mantell has details.
Oil traders here in New York on the Mercantile Exchange said they had no idea that Yamani was about to be fired, but they took it as a sign that world oil prices would start to rise. Yamani had been leading OPEC in a price war over the past 10 months. Saudi Arabia, the largest producer in the cartel, had raised its production and created an oil glut. That lowered the price of oil by 50%. Analysts say Saudi Arabia's King Fahd supposedly had enough of the price war and of Yamani. King Fahd has said that he would like to see the price of oil rise to about $18 a barrel. And at noon today, New York time, when Saudi Arabia's new oil minister called for an emergency OPEC meeting, traders at the Mercantile Exchange frantically bid up oil prices. They were betting that King Fahd and his new minister were going to try to set a new policy of higher prices in motion. I'm Barbara Mantell in New York.
Section 2, News in Detail.
Sheikh Ahmad Zaki Yamani is generally regarded as the mastermind behind the Arab oil strategy of the 1970s, the man who introduced the word petrodollars into our vocabulary, and who helped bring about one of the most dramatic shifts of international economic and political power in this century. NPR's Elizabeth Colton has a report.
Yamani was appointed to the post of Saudi Minister of Petroleum and Mineral Resources in 1962, and it was then he began leading the campaign to wrest control of Arab oil resources from foreign-owned companies. He was only 32 years old when he took over his country's oil ministry, but he was then among the few Saudis to have had higher Western education, including, in his case, legal training at Harvard. Although Yamani was only a commoner in the kingdom, some members of the royal family had begun to recognize the contribution such a technocrat could make to the Saudi government. Then Crown Prince Faisal, later the king, championed young Yamani and gave him a clear mandate to do whatever necessary to keep his country's oil benefits home in Saudi Arabia. A natural diplomat, Yamani quickly became the unproclaimed leader of the Organization of Arab Petroleum Exporting Countries, as well as the global cartel OPEC. In November and December of 1973, Sheikh Yamani toured Western capitals to explain OPEC's radical policies, including why oil prices were going to go up by 70%. His announcement shocked the world, and his name became an international household word. In London, one journalist wrote at the time that Sheikh Yamani of Saudi Arabia was the most formidable Eastern emissary to arrive in Europe since the Tartars swept into Russia or the Muslim hordes reached the walls of Vienna in the Middle Ages. In 1975, Yamani was the target when terrorists seized OPEC headquarters in Vienna and took the ministers hostage for several days. Ever since then, Yamani surrounded himself with tough British bodyguards, and he kept his movements secret. Whenever he was seen abroad, he appeared as a superstar with his entourage. At home in the royal kingdom, however, his position was somewhat different. He remained a commoner and consequently always an outsider, useful to the monarchy only as a technocrat who could manage Saudi wealth for the true owners, the royal family. Sometimes at OPEC meetings, he would have to fly back home to consult with the king before proceeding with negotiations. At such times, ministers from revolutionary member states like Iran would criticize Yamani for being only a lackey with no power to make decisions on his own. At the same time, many observers believe that Yamani's ouster yesterday was caused by King Fahd's irritation with Yamani's power base outside the kingdom. OPEC specialist Yusuf Ibrahim of the Wall Street Journal says Yamani got caught between demands. Yamani is also said to be an extremely sensitive and religious man. He has been concerned that peoples of the world should try to understand each other. For example, in a conversation once with this reporter, Sheikh Yamani said he believed all world leaders, like himself, should have at least an introductory course in social anthropology in order to be tolerant of other cultures. The cosmopolitan Sheikh Yamani will be remembered as not only a wizard of oil economics, but perhaps more as a leading diplomat who brought the Arab world into the fore again and changed the course of late 20th century history. I'm Elizabeth Colton in Washington.
Section 3. Special Report.
This week in the United States, the Senate voted to reject the $200 million in additional aid to the Philippines. That money was approved by the House after President Corazon Aquino delivered an emotional address to a joint session of Congress during her visit a few weeks ago. In that speech, Aquino thanked those lawmakers who she said had balanced U.S. strategic interests against human concerns and turned U.S. policy against Ferdinand Marcos.
However, the conflict between strategic U.S. defense interests and the everyday human needs of Filipinos remains at the heart of U.S.-Philippine relations. It was a major issue in the Senate debate over increased economic aid when concerns were raised about the Philippines' commitment to retaining two major U.S. military bases. Nowhere is this conflict more tangible than in the Philippine base towns themselves. NPR's Alan Burlow has a report.
The frightening roar and fearful symmetry of an F-4 Phantom fighter plane racing down the runway at Subic Bay Naval Station are quickly lost in wonder as the 23-ton Phantom arches gracefully into the blue morning sky and disappears among the clouds of the South China Sea. The exact nature of today's mission is unknown. Perhaps it is a routine exercise or training hours for a young pilot on one of the more than 200 daily flights from Subic Bay. It is impossible to say what thoughts occupy this pilot's mind, whether they pertain to the endless briefings on the strategic importance of Subic Bay, to the threat of communism, to the issues of nuclear war, or to the theoretical battles of superpower strategists who have him racing through the heavens away from the city of Alangapo. Alangapo, located about 50 miles northwest of Manila, is the city just outside the Subic Bay Naval Station. Alangapo is where the Filipinos live and where the Americans come to play. In a way, Alangapo is a microcosm of the tensions in U.S.-Philippine relations. Before the Subic Bay installation was built, Alangapo was little more than a fishing village. Today, the local economy benefits from tens of millions of dollars spent there annually. At the same time, the extraordinary and pervasive influence of Subic Bay on the economy and culture of Olongapo and the Philippines as a whole has led many Filipinos to question whether the base should be allowed to stay. On any given day, there are 10,000 Americans at Subic Bay. They deal with the big issues like nuclear war and communism. But Philippine President Corazon Aquino must deal with more mundane matters like the economic crisis her country faces in places like Olongapo and places like Pagasa.
Puno na kami doon eh. Puno na, marami na mga nagbakasyon doon sa amin.
Pagasa is the barrio where the city of Olongapo dumps its garbage. It is also home for the city's most destitute. While Pagasa is separated from the Subic Bay Naval Station by only a few yards, a moat of raw sewage and a fence of barbed wire, the concerns of its residents could not be more distant. Virgilio Franci has lived here almost 10 years. He, his wife, and 8 children occupy a one-room scrapwood shack. They live off the dump, collecting bottles and plastic cartons.
In one day, you get almost 45, 50 pesos in one day.
And who does the work? You or all your children?
All of us.
All of you together?
Yep.
Can make 45 pesos?
Yes. All of us in one day.
Mm-hmm. And do you also find food here or no?
We found food, but it is a junk food.
Can you eat that food?
Sometimes. But when it tastes no good, we throw it.
Franci says some days his children go hungry. The earnings he mentioned for his family of 10 come to about $2 a day. In the local dialect, Pagasa means hope. Last year, Virgilio Franci found a solid gold bracelet in the dump. He sold it for about $10. In Pagasa, you breathe the unmistakable acrid smoke of smoldering garbage coughed up by fires that never go out. In Pagasa, there are thick clouds of flies, millions of flies, humming their monotonous song of decay as they swarm about the mountains of garbage rising 10, 15, 30 feet into the air. Catalino Tranci, his wife and 9 children live off the dump. Near the entrance to their mud floor shack, there is a pen with 8 pigs and an oil drum filled above its rim with blood-stained bones. I asked Mr. Tranci why he collected these.
There is a buyer who buys that skulls and bones.
And how much money do you get for skulls and bones?
That's 75 centavos a kilo.
There is a dumpster in front of Tronsi's house that says, donated to Olongapo City by the U.S. Navy. Another sign bears one of the slogans of a former mayor. It reads, quote, "It's forbidden to be lazy in this city." Some 200 families live here in Pagasa. Chickens and dogs and rats can be seen running about. A little girl walks through the flattened cans and the bottle caps, dragging a plastic bag on a string, a sort of kite. She falls into the broken glass and ashes and doesn't cry. In the Pagasa, the houses are of wood, tin, and cardboard boxes that say things like "this side up" or "fragile." There's a house with a faded green "Merry Christmas" sign, another that says "God bless you." There is irony here for journalists, but there is no electricity or basic services. The U.S. Navy is in Olongapo because it is one of the best naturally protected harbors in the world. It is there because the Pentagon thinks Subic Bay is essential to protecting U.S. security interests in Asia, the Pacific, and the Indian Ocean. But whether the U.S. will be allowed to remain in Olongapo will eventually be decided by Filipinos. In a national referendum promised by President Aquino, they will be asking what kind of friend the U.S. has been, if the bases serve Philippine security interests as well as the very real human needs of their country, if the income from the bases offsets the damage done to the structure of Philippine society and to Philippine sovereignty. As this debate heats up, the United States faces a difficult task in convincing people that its concerns extend beyond global issues of security down to the very real everyday problems faced by ordinary Filipinos. I'm Alan Berlow, reporting.